Think globally, act locally, but for the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 6th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin this week with a little bit of the economic mojo we were left with last week. Friday's What Is Even Going On Here jobs report. So many new jobs and so low an unemployment rate that you got to go back to the 1960s to find something similar. We may yet have a recession this year, or we may not. But for now, anyway, and certainly to the puzzlement of the Federal Reserve, this economy looks pretty good. And it turns out the global economy might not be doing as badly as people had been worried about either. Yes, it slowed in 2022, and maybe it'll slow a bit more this year. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports to Get Us Going, the global economy is a big place, you know, and some parts of it do turn out to be doing better than expected.
Energy prices have fallen. Inflation is slowing. And in many countries, COVID is no longer a serious economic drag.
The global outlook has undoubtedly improved over the past couple of months.
Neil Shearing at Capital Economics says the outlook for Europe had seemed dire, with Russia's war in Ukraine making natural gas scarce and expensive. But in the past few months,
the price of European natural gas has absolutely collapsed, and that really removes a substantial headwind to the Eurozone's economy.
Europe has done a good job of conserving, plus
we've had an extremely mild winter here in Europe. For a large part of January, we were actually building supplies of gas in storage, believe it or not.
China, meanwhile, has jettisoned its zero COVID policy, says Shearing, and unleashed a wave of consumer spending.
I think the economic rebound in China is going to be more rapid than investors and other people are anticipating.
But China's rebound won't be anything like the revenge spending spree we saw in the U.S., says Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
They did not build up the kind of excess saving in China that we saw built up in the U.S., partly because for a large number of Chinese, they were having to survive on their savings.
Posen says major emerging markets, Brazil, India, Mexico, Indonesia, are doing pretty well. And in spite of continuing problems getting grain out of Ukraine, worries about food insecurity are falling. Morning Consult's Sonnet Frisbee says the polling firm asked consumers worldwide if they're worried about being able to pay for groceries.
I was really surprised to find that there's not a big difference in emerging and developed markets.
Bottom line, if the global economy does end up performing a little better than economists have been predicting, that's only going to help the economy here at home. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Just because we do believe context is important on this program, got to point out here on the maybe not so great side of the economic ledger that Dell joined the layoff club today. 6,600 jobs, about 5% of the company. Ticker symbol D-E-L-L. Clever. Right? Off 3% today, down generally at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today is the deadline for farmers and ranchers in this economy to respond to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Census of Agriculture. It dates back to 1840, that census does, when most of us lived and worked on farms and ranches. The USDA sends the census out every 5 years now and gets a snapshot of American agriculture back. And new this time around, questions about precision agriculture, hemp production, also internet access. They are alongside the usual questions about farmer demographics and how much farmland is in use and how much money farmers are making. Much as with the national once-every-decade census, the government is going to use the information they get to divvy up federal money and to figure out ag policy. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
Jamie Viramontes has been getting a lot of postcards from the government.
We definitely get a lot of reminders
to respond to the long and detailed census of agriculture. Vera Montes and her husband Cole, who grow row crops in southern New Mexico, see it as an opportunity.
It's a great way for policymakers to truly get a picture of what's going on farms.
It is the basic source for information about agriculture as an industry.
Daniel Sumner is an agricultural economist at UC Davis. He says the government uses ag census data to target resources, and just about everyone else connected to the farm economy uses it to make business decisions.
If you're thinking about where you're going to put your wheat processing plant, you're going to go to the Census of Agriculture.
The Ag Census also tells us who is operating American farms. Unsurprisingly, it's mostly white men, but Katie Densman, a rural sociologist at Iowa State University, says methodology changes in recent surveys show there are more women and farmers of color than we thought. And the profession is aging fast. That's why the Ag Census tries to identify young and beginning farmers.
So we can get an idea of who is actually entering farming as we get these people who are going to very suddenly start aging out.
This year's response from Vera Montes' farm will show Jamie and Cole are growing fewer heritage green chilies and more cotton.
Any of our crops that require a lot of hand labor, it's just not feasible to grow in a large scale anymore.
Because of a massive shortage of farm workers, which she hopes the data, when it's released next year, will reflect. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
One of the generally accepted truisms of life in this streaming age has been that even if a TV show is canceled, no new episodes are being made, that show would live on in repeats or some other kind of streaming afterlife. Viewers thought so, and cast and crew of those shows came to expect it, and the royalty checks that came from it. That does, though, seem to be changing. Last year, HBO Max disappeared dozens of original shows and films from its library. And just last week, Showtime did the same for shows like American Gigolo and Super Pumped. Marketplace's Matt Levin looked into what's going on.
If you wanted to watch the family sitcom Gordita Chronicles right now,
you would have to come to my house and sit on my couch and hold my dog and watch my DVDs.
Bridget Munoz-Leibovitz is an old friend of mine and the Gordita Chronicles showrunner. The show centered on a Dominican family immigrating to Miami in the 1980s with a John Hughes-y polish. Here's part of a trailer, which you can still find on YouTube.
I'll be back by 10.
9. And if you get kidnapped, call Ashley's mom. She has more money than us.
No kidding. They have a dishwasher that's not their children.
Bridget came on as showrunner because the story felt personal. Her mom came to the U.S. from Colombia.
I was so charmed by the story and saw so much of myself in it, so much of my family's narrative.
Gordita Chronicles premiered on HBO Max last year, got some good reviews and social media love. But a few months after its debut, HBO Max canceled the second season. Then Bridget learned in December that HBO Max was just erasing the show from the platform entirely. She felt embarrassed.
It made it seem like it wasn't good enough to hang. Like in the way that maybe you're not invited to a party because you're not cool enough.
The creative community is in this state of dumbfoundedness, I think, where they're saying, wait a second, my show can just disappear.
Matt Bellany covers Hollywood for the news site Puck. Up until last year, the thought of taking shows off a platform was the complete opposite of streaming's MO.
They wanted to greenlight the most shows, and it was a volume play. We have to have a robust library and own it all, control it all, and it's just volume, volume, volume.
But Wall Street is now demanding profits, not just subscribers. HBO Max took a look at a bunch of shows that were out of production and basically said,
we can save ourselves money from not having to pay residuals to certain profit participants and talent associated with the shows if we are not exhibiting the shows on the streaming service.
Actors and writers and directors on canceled shows frequently get checks as long as those shows remain on the platform. Laura Blum-Smith is the research director at the Writers Guild of America.
When content is made for a streaming service, the writer gets a flat fee. for each year that the content is available on the service.
For her part, Bridget thinks that if the show had been on the platform for maybe 5 years, she'd have pocketed tens of thousands. Warner Brothers Discovery, the conglomerate that owns HBO Max, hasn't disclosed how much money it saved from The Purge. It didn't respond to her interview request. Blum Smith believes the original sin is in the fact that Warner Brothers and Discovery merged in the first place. The new conglomerate is $50 billion in debt.
We're getting what you'd expect from consolidation. The company is using its market power to slash programming and cut costs by squeezing workers.
She says when streamers cut costs, they may resort to old programming habits.
A lot of the casualties have been projects created by or centering women and people of color.
Like the animated show Tuca and Birdie with Tiffany Haddish and Ali Wong, or the sitcom Chad with Nassim Pedrad. Warner Brothers Discovery has been trying to sell some of the shows they disappeared to other streaming services. Gordita Chronicles has not found another home yet, beyond Bridget's couch and DVD player. Oh, actually, there's one other place you could catch an episode.
You know where you can watch it? You can watch it on American Airlines or JetBlue flights to Miami or New York.
She hasn't watched the show since it got canceled. It's just too sad. Also, she'd have to hook her DVD player back up. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
There's a small business jobs index that comes from the good people at IHS Market that measures national employment growth for businesses with less than 50 people. The three-month trend line is up, which is good, and North Carolina stays at the top of the list for small business employment growth for 7 months in a row. So we called Amelia Freeman Lind. She owns Freeman's Creative. That's a craft retail store and learning center in Raleigh to see how things are going.
There's just a lot of reasons that things have been going a little bit better than they felt at the beginning of last year. The first thing has really just been staffing. We really struggled the previous year to hire people, even to interview people. And over the course of 2022, we really brought in some great new people and have had a really great staff. So that really feels like the biggest difference is having a great team around makes it all feel a lot better. Class attendance is always going to be one of those things I always feel like I'm guessing what classes are going to be successful, what times of year people want to take classes. January's been great. Everybody starts off the year wanting to take classes, wanting to learn new skills, wanting to get some creativity into their lives. So we'll see about in June if everybody's on vacation or if they still want to learn to knit. The thing that's been most challenging in the past year is that I really feel like I've run a different business every year since we opened. We celebrated our fifth birthday in November, which is a big milestone, and we had a really awesome party with an alpaca and some tattoo artists doing craft themed tattoos. But I just don't feel like I can look back at previous years and be like, okay, this is what I can expect January to be like, or this is what I can expect sales to be, or even this is what day of the week I can expect to be our busiest. It feels like not only is it year over year, but a really different business, but every month I feel like I'm still kind of guessing at how to run this. And that could just be small business life in general, or that could just be that everybody's lives are still a little bit upended and we're all still figuring out our routines. But that's been a big challenge. I just don't feel like I have data to look back at. And I don't feel like I'm not sure I've learned anything in 5 years of running the business. I'm not planning to go anywhere, and anybody in small business or retail in general is probably going to tell you, you don't save for the money. It's very hard to pay yourself as much as you might in another job. Even with having our best sales year ever, we had lower profits last year, which directly affects how much I'm able to pay myself. And I do it because I think not only is creativity important in the general world and the broader sense, but I do think it's really important for our community to have a place to get supplies locally, to be able to ask their questions. And it's always great having new folks come in and want to pick up a craft, want to learn a new craft if they already do one thing, or just the brand new beginners who just feel like you know, I want to find a way to bring my creativity to life and make something with my hands. And that's what we're here for.
Amelia Freeman Lind in Raleigh, North Carolina, teaching and selling arts and crafts. Coming up.
And while we thought we were going to get some rate relief, that didn't happen.
People, do not count your finance chickens until they hatch. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 34 points today, about a 10th percent, 33,891. The NASDAQ down 119 points, 1%, 11,887. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points, 6-tenths percent, 41.11 there. So look, if you thought about your 401k lately, if your default feeling about that topic is anxiety, which I understand right now, you are definitely not alone. On the good news side, Vanguard Group reports that about 90% of the investors in its 401k style plans maintained or even increased their rate of retirement savings in 2022. But in that same year, hardship distributions, which let you withdraw money early without the usual tax penalties, they hit a record high of 2.8% of plan holders. Fidelity Investments reported about 2.4% of their 401k plan participants made hardship withdrawals, about a quarter more than last year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We don't quite know yet what 2023 is going to bring, but the U.S. Department of Energy says more solar power is in the offing. The Energy Information Administration is forecasting more than half of the new capacity that will be added to the electricity grid this year will be solar, and battery capacity, which you got to have to store the energy generated by solar and wind, is on track to more than double this year. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
For a long time, wind was proliferating much more quickly in the U.S. than solar. But Joshua Rhodes at the University of Texas at Austin says not anymore.
While wind continues to get built across the U.S., its pace has slowed down, whereas solar has started to ramp up. It kind of feels like solar is where wind was about 7 or 8 years ago.
Why? Well, for one, Rhodes says solar has finally gotten cheaper.
Wind was often the cheapest thing to do over the past decade, but solar appears to be taking that mantle.
In addition to that,
a lot of the best locations for wind have essentially already been taken.
Tyler Hodge is at the Energy Information Administration.
Now there's more incentive and more availability of locations to build new solar projects.
Demand for solar has also been rising from all kinds of customers, says Abigail Ross Harper at the Solar Energy Industries Association.
Homeowners that want to put it on their roofs.
Businesses that want to put up solar panels to save money.
And then utilities. Utilities are a huge source of demand. And obviously, you know, the customers of utilities are demanding it. And so utilities are procuring it.
It's not just demand for solar panels and clean energy that's growing. Demand for better batteries to store that solar energy to use later is growing too. And Dan Kamen at the University of California, Berkeley, says the technology is catching up.
Because of all the interest in storage now and interest in going green, we're now seeing long-duration batteries starting to enter the market.
And he says that is maybe the most exciting development.
Solar is now unambiguously the cheapest new form of energy you can put on the grid. And we can just ramp that way up, but it becomes massively more effective when we ramp up storage.
This year, we're likely to see both. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
According to the most recent Consumer Price Index, the one that came out back in the middle of January, utility bills in this economy, specifically electricity, were up 14.3% in December from a year earlier. Part of that is because inflation hits almost everything, as you know, but part of it is also because utility companies have been dealing with increased costs of their own the past number of years. And one way they're trying to handle those expenses is through securitization. And if you are thinking to yourself right now, wait, wasn't that a thing in the 2008 financial crisis? And didn't it end badly? Yes. And yes. Marketplace's Lily Jamali covers energy and utilities for us.
The first major experiment with utility securitization traces its roots more than two decades back.
So the rumor's true? They're taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
That's an infamous recording of two employees at the now defunct Texas energy giant Enron boasting about gouging ratepayers here in the West. Enron and other power traders had manipulated California's newly deregulated electricity markets. As a result, California utility PG&E filed for bankruptcy, and another threatened to follow, says Mark Toney, who directs the Utility Reform Network.
The state had to purchase emergency power at extremely high prices. And so there was a huge amount of debt left over. That was the first utility securitization in the country.
Utilities issued long-term bonds to finance the emergency debt racked up when California purchased all that emergency power and passed on the expense to ratepayers.
And for about 20 years, when you looked at your monthly bill, there was something.
A line item.
Paying back the debt.
But when that debt was almost paid off, another crisis hit. Wildfires sparked by equipment owned by PG&E and other utilities. California responded by setting up a $21 billion wildfire insurance fund, half of it paid, again, by customers.
That now shows up on our monthly utility bills. And while we thought we were going to get some rate relief, that didn't happen.
Securitization isn't limited to California. More than half the states have legislation in place permitting utilities to use it to pay off massive one-time expenses. Bloomberg estimates the market for recovery bonds exploded by almost 800% just over the last year. They've covered a range of costs from disaster repairs to pandemic collection shortfalls to old power plant retirements.
It prevents the rate shock that you would have if you're immediately flowing something like that through.
Richard McMahon is senior vice president at the Edison Electric Institute, an association representing all U.S. publicly traded electric companies. He says securitization works by spreading out costs over time, and it can be cheaper than traditional utility financing because the bonds are backed by the state.
It's much lower cost in terms of interest expense that you need to pay investors by doing it through securitization.
But advocates say the one-off events increasingly paid for by securitization aren't so one-off when you factor in climate change. In the case of Winter Storm Uri, which hit Texas and states nearby 2 years ago, prices for gas and electricity skyrocketed. Maria Reyes, deputy director of the Texas-based nonprofit Commission Shift, calls the incident an industrial failure.
They didn't weatherize their equipment. They didn't prepare for what was coming.
Reyes says ratepayers shouldn't be stuck paying the sky-high energy prices that natural gas companies charge, which utilities passed through to customers.
The companies, the industry, the market, the shareholders, they should bear the burden.
At a time when one in six American families are behind on their utility bills, according to the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. Bruce Biewald, CEO of the consulting firm Synapse Energy Economics, says while securitization has its benefits, the approach requires scrutiny and oversight.
In a lot of cases, those costs maybe shouldn't be recovered, or maybe regulators, if they reviewed the costs, would see that they weren't all prudently incurred.
As the industry turns to securitization more, he says customers could end up paying for emergency costs for decades and more frequently. In Los Angeles, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one does hope they will avoid easily parodyable lines like Fortune Favors the Brave. Hello, Matt Damon. But with the crypto implosion, booze ads seem to be taking over a lot of the Super Bowl ad inventory. And remember, it's not going to be Budweiser. The beer company gave up on its 33-year deal with the NFL back in June. So we're going to see Miller, and Heineken, Remy Martin Cognac, and Crown Royal Whiskey, among others. I, by the way, am taking the Chiefs. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Comes to us from David Gura, one-time staff reporter here, one-time Friday regular, now works, you know, somewhere else. He posted this on Twitter today, an update from Fitch, the ratings company. Here's what they said. Fiscal tailwinds that helped U.S. sovereign debt to GDP to fall in 2022 following the COVID-19 shock are fading. Translation there, we've got more debt and a slowing economy. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.